This is The Guardian.
Die KI-Teammitglieder von Asana verknüpfen ihre Ziele mit relevanten Projekten. So ist jedem Team seine Rolle im Gesamtbild klar. Asana, die führende Plattform für KI-gestütztes Workmanagement. Jetzt kostenlos testen auf asana.com.
How can governments play a pivotal role as the world shifts? From decarbonizing the economy to sustainable care systems, bold government strategies are needed now more than ever. Get informed by listening to Government Insights, the new podcast from EY Parthenon. This series explores how government executives can transform their strategies into actions that are future-proof and sustainable. Government Insights is out now. Download today wherever you get your podcasts.
It's news that makes most things feel almost irrelevant. Donald Trump is the American president again, and he won a thumping victory.
Yes, I want to thank the American people for the extraordinary honor of being elected your 47th president and your 45th president.
Albeit through gritted teeth, some people seem to be trying to make the best of it.
As the closest of allies, the UK and US will continue to work together to protect our shared values of freedom and democracy.
But what does this really mean, both for America and the rest of us? I'm John Harris, and you're listening to Politics Weekly UK for The Guardian. Joining me today is The Guardian columnist and host of our sister podcast, Politics Weekly America, Jonathan Freeland. Hi, Johnny.
How are you doing, John?
Well, that really opens up a whole world of pain, but let's not go there. I'm sure you feel similarly.
I do. I'm trying to sort of, bluster through it. But yeah, no, it's not a glad, confident morning by any means at all.
It really isn't. You're in Washington, D.C., I'm told, and you have been up all night. I don't know whether you've had any rest. It's not really a moment for relaxation at all, is it?
No, I managed to grab a couple of sort of fitful, restless hours. I was actually at the election night party, in quotes, for Kamala Harris at her old university, Howard University, historic black college in Washington, D.C. Huge crowd was there ready to celebrate, you know, the first woman president, a black woman as president, and just charted the evening as result after result came in and the mood became more and more forlorn. So that was a bleak experience, and just, you know, a few people clinging to hope in sort of around midnight when there was just at least a theoretical possibility. But you really had seen early on, she just wasn't doing well enough in the places she'd have had to have run up big numbers. She wasn't. And therefore you could see that where the trend was. And it felt like a rerun of those depressing election nights. I mean, you and I have been through them in different parts of the world over the years, but this felt a lot like 2016. And in some ways, actually, you know, where it differed was because 2016 was a narrow win for Donald Trump. This was, really in the terms of a 50-50 divided country like America, a blowout win. I mean, he really swept most of. They're not all in yet, but most of those battleground states. It was very clear, and he also won the popular vote, which he hadn't done before. And, you know, a lot of people didn't think he would manage to do that. So it's a comprehensive win for Donald Trump.
And you're allowed to say this because you're a columnist. How do you feel? I don't mean in terms of your physical state. I mean emotionally now.
Well, I don't feel good about it at all. I feel very fearful for America, you know, a country that I've been, you know, one way or another kind of wrapped up with for decades, and it made a big part of my professional life. I fear for its future. I mean, he is an authoritarian with fascist impulses, and he's now going to have pretty well unchecked power, because it looks as if he certainly won the Senate, or the Republicans have won the Senate, may well keep hold of the House, so he'll have all of Congress. You have a Supreme Court that is made in his image, and that has said that the president has sweeping absolute immunity for any official acts. And one third of that bench was appointed by him. So I think we're looking at unchecked power in the hands of a man who has said he wants to be a dictator on day one. He always qualified and said only for one day. But those are his impulses. You look at what he was doing in the campaign and saying he wanted to deploy the military against enemies from within. He's been looking around at the press and wondering which broadcasters he could shut down. I think those are his instincts, and I don't see where the restraint is now on him. There were some restraints institutionally in his first term, partly because he was a novice and didn't know how to play the system, and there were a few institutionalists around him who sort of acted as restraint. I don't see that there now. And I fear sort of for the globe. You know, I mean, there is a climate crisis, the planet is burning. And here is someone, I heard him speak in Salem, Virginia, on the weekend, on Saturday, talking about oil as liquid gold, and we are going to turn on the taps, because I think he thinks this is a way to reduce the global oil price. And he wants to drill in the Alaska Natural Wildlife or National Wildlife Reserve. This is the last pristine wilderness in North America. He wants to drill it for oil. I fear for Ukraine. You think about their future. I feel very, very fearful.
I am struck by how much the center left, for want of a better term, in other words, the Democrats and their sort of wider political and cultural constituency, have been wrong footed here. This isn't just about the result, is it? The political reality underlying that, it seems to me, is not what they thought. And it's maybe not what I thought either. And that sort of leads to an obvious question, which is, why are the likes of us, do you think, and you may not include yourself in this, but why are people on our side, do you think, so bad at understanding the phenomenon of Donald Trump? Because let's not forget, 2016 took lots of us by surprise, similarly, and the same thing's happened again.
Yeah, I think it's really hard for people to see someone who they believe is unqualified and disqualified from being president, who, you know, in a way morally should not be there. It's very hard to see that other people don't see that. So, you know, that it becomes so obvious.
Millions and millions of them. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, there is this sort of cognitive disconnect where you think if you tell someone, this person has been found liable in a court for sexual abuse, which the judge then clarified and said meets a common definition of rape. That's what the judge said in the case. You think that would be enough to settle the question of whether that person should be running the country? And that has happened in case after case after case, you know, two impeachments, four different felony cases outstanding against him, which of course will now go away because he'll just make them go away. You know, it feels obvious that this boorish, obnoxious, malignant narcissist should be nowhere near power. And yet there are other people who don't think it's obvious at all. And that is the sort of there is a conversational dialogue of the deaf in a way that goes on in America where there are two sides who don't really even speak the same language. And it's partly because they don't have the same body of facts. I mean, I was interviewing Trump supporters at these rallies, and you present to them what to you are obvious facts about him, and they will just dismiss them. They don't believe they're true because they have they live in a media ecosystem that tells them they're not true.
That's the next step here, in as much as this boils down to this question, which is chronically overlooked still, I think, in a lot of political journalism, which is about where people get their facts from. I'm increasingly used to having encounters with people that instantly kind of open a lid into a world I know nothing about. And suddenly they will start quoting reams of stuff that they've seen on social media that locks together into a narrative, which they feel is very powerful and puts them logically in a completely different place from me, right?
Yeah.
That really, really is central to what's happened here, isn't it?
I think it really is. I mean, I would speak to people who would say, you know, black is white and day is night in terms of Donald Trump. And I would just sort of say, you know, when you say you hear, where is that coming from? And they would list that the one woman I spoke to said she watched Newsmax. That's the channel that people go to if they think Fox News is not right wing enough.
Right.
And she watched that. And then she said, well, but I read too. I read Breitbart, right-wing site, Daily Caller, and she went through them all, and her diet was entirely far right. And so in that world, what you and I would consider the proven facts of Donald Trump, even including, you know, court convictions, the fact that other people point to them is just proof of a biased, liberal, elite, communist-run media. Donald Trump, I think, intuited this early on, that there's nothing that they can say or do about him that doesn't actually strengthen him. Because when they say that he is a felon or that he's a narcissist or that he's a fascist, it just enables them to say, there they go again, the liberal media who have it in for Donald Trump. It proves their bias. I always do think that, you know, we are only not going down this road because there is still, battered and bruised and flawed though it is, a space in the form of specifically the BBC where there is a shared body of agreed facts. You know, when Partygate happened, once the BBC had the sort of key pictures on the news, even the right, even supporters of Boris Johnson, had to admit those were facts. The same does not happen here. I mean, if Partygate happened in the United States, photographic proof would have been dismissed as fake news or AI.
Oh, yeah, sure. They'd have said the pictures were doctored.
Yes, they would. And half the electorate would not have believed it. And so that, I think we, you know, the BBC is all that stands between us in Britain and going down this road where it's not even just social media. They have a whole media ecosystem, including TV networks and so on.
So I, as you know, have spent a lot of the last 15 years trying to understand to some extent, or empathise even, with people who vote for Trump and Brexit and Nigel Farage and so on. And throughout this election campaign in the States, watching it from a distance, I started to feel that Trumpism was so brazen this time and the conversations that I saw with his supporters were so out there that I really felt my sort of empathetic elastic starting to snap. And this sense dawning on me, well, maybe you can't look for bigger reasons for their support for him other than people being nasty and racist and bigoted, right? Now, that's a sort of sweeping critique that I'd always resisted and said, no, there's more to it than that. You have to empathise a little bit more. And I felt that starting to slip. Did you have that feeling this time around?
Yes, I think maybe you've been more strenuous and heroic in your efforts over the years.
Busting a gut to be empathetic.
I mean, I definitely have
I'll just make that clear. Not with everybody at all, but the idea that that many million Americans were completely beyond the pale, or that everybody who voted for Brexit was a bigger, I found difficult. But I did find that was being tested, I felt, this time.
Yes. No, first of all, I'm joking with you, obviously. I mean, the effort to understand and be curious has been essential and compulsory for any journalist, I would say, since Trump's victory in 2016, and it should have been before. And, you know, I was making efforts to do that before, because obviously this man has a phenomenal appeal, and you have to, if you're analysing politics, you've got to understand what that is. But I do think that part of it now, rather than just thinking of the phrase in Britain was, you know, legitimate concerns about immigration, the phrase here was economic distress, that the only reason people were rallying to Donald Trump was economic distress. Look, that's definitely part of it. And Harris suffered from being part of a Biden administration, which has presided over soaring inflation. Now, inflation has since receded and the economy is doing brilliantly by British or European standards, but people really do feel it, that they, you know, they look to replace an old car that stopped working and the price is shocking.
Yeah.
The fact that economists are telling you that, oh, now inflation's receded, it doesn't stop the fact that it is now much more expensive to get a house or a car or pay rent than it was 4 years ago. That is just a fact. I think that is the key headwind that Kamala Harris was going into, where you had 65-70% of the country saying that America was on the wrong track. It is very hard to run in an election like that. And if anything, you could almost say give Kamala Harris credit for just being even competitive in that environment. I think she made a mistake by not distancing herself more from Biden. So that's sort of normal politics. But in addition to that, you have to face the fact that people in this country are drawn to, and not just here, the authoritarian strongman message and persona of Donald Trump, that rather than thinking that was a negative that he somehow overcame, it was a positive and is a positive draw for big bodies of support. We've seen this surge in numbers among men. On the sister podcast, you kindly mentioned Politics Weekly America. We spoke with a very brilliant Hispanic journalist, Nikki McCann Ramirez, who's from a Mexican-American family, who admits honestly that the kind of machismo of Donald Trump speaks to people in Hispanic communities. We saw it with Black American vote among Black American men, 12% last time, 20% this time. And people, again, Black American commentators have been saying there is something about the swagger and sort of almost caricatured male persona of Donald Trump that resonated with men across I mean, this was with massive with white men too. I don't want to single out minorities. The point is that it went across the board, young men rallying to him, loving this kind of cultural defiance, this middle finger that Donald Trump shows to all the wagging finger scolds who are saying, you can't say this, you can't say that. They love the fact that the people like you and me and The Guardian get shocked by everything he says and does.
Yeah.
People love the defiance that he embodies.
But the defiance shines light, perhaps, on something which has definitely worked to Donald Trump's advantage, which is that Donald Trump doesn't just run against the Democratic Party. He runs against the wider sort of cultural and political left, which goes way beyond the boundaries of the Democrats. The left very often looks bossy and puritanical, right? Yeah. That's almost what woke means when it's used pejoratively. And Trump's success as a candidate might lie in that kind of screw you, we don't care. I'm not here to judge you. Be who you like. I'm not somebody who's going to get into the vocabulary of microaggressions and people using the wrong pronouns and all those things. Do what you want, right? So in that sense, he's a kind of liberating figure relative to the left.
Completely. And you can absolutely pick that up. One of his most effective ads. This will be uncomfortable for a lot of Guardian readers, listeners. I know it will. But one of his ads that they, and I know it was effective because they used it more and more and more, said that Kamala Harris was for they, them, he's for you. Yeah. And that ad was all about transgender participation in sport and the, as he put it, this is his language, not mine, you know, men being on women's swimming teams. It is that rally I referred to in Virginia. He brought on the local women's swimming team, all of them, including the team captain. This was young women, all supporting Donald Trump because, again, how he put it, a male was on their team. And it was one of the hugest moments in the whole rally. I mean, so it's not just about the economy and sort of big things. This one, he tapped into something there that the other side, and I think you're completely right to say this isn't about just the Democrats. By the other side, he means the media, the universities, the HR department at work that tells you that, you know, you can't say this and you can't say that. He means all of it. And it's very gendered because the image of this person with a wagging finger telling you what you can and can't say is, in this right-wing imagination, a woman. And Kamala Harris fitted that bill.
Yeah, it's sort of, they've got this vision, haven't they, of sort of matriarchal authoritarianism. That's what they think. The fact that they combined it in Harris's case with clearly lots and lots of less than subtle messages about the fact she's a woman of colour, right? So you get a sort of modern set of messages about the woke HR department with something that taps deep into America's long-standing messed upness as far as race is concerned. And I suppose in that sense, in the worst possible way, then the Trump campaign really has something to play with.
The product he was selling was fear. You have to fear going broke because the economy is tanking, as he described it, whatever the facts. You have to fear being killed by marauding illegal immigrants crossing the border coming to kill you. And he would have relatives of, you know, the bereaved relatives on stage whose family were killed by people who'd moved across into America. And third, it will sound absurd, he would say you have to fear your kids turning trans in schools that want to turn them trans, to want to turn your boys into girls and your girls into boys. It will sound absurd and ridiculous to many people listening to this podcast, but those three things were the messages and they all turned on fear.
What do you think he can do in 4 years? And possibly longer, because let's not rule out him trying to amend the Constitution so he gets even longer, although he'd be very old. But let's focus on the next 4 years. What do you think he can do?
Well, I think, you know, you can look at policy things and you can think that that there may be demands, pressure on him to make a national abortion ban. I think he will resist that because he thinks his policy of letting it go to the states was very effective for him electorally. I think there'll be tax cuts for the richest people. I think you have to have a massive worry about public health now in the hands of an anti-vaxxer conspiracy theorist.
Who talks about, this is Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who talks about banning vaccines completely.
Yeah, I mean, and Trump says and said on the platform, I'm just going to give you all the different health agencies in the country. You can supervise those. The one I want to be in charge of is liquid gold oil. He wants to focus on that himself because he sees money to be made there for America. I think internationally, NATO, I would say, is now a dead letter just by the fact of his arrival in office. He doesn't have to formally leave NATO, but we know he does not believe in the Article 5 commitment to that you defend any NATO member. We know he doesn't believe that.
Right, which is the tune Vladimir Putin longs to hear.
Yes, because he's saying, in effect, if Lithuania's attacked, nothing to do with me. I don't care. And that's the green light to Putin. I think it's, if not curtain, something close to it for Ukraine, perhaps even as an independent sovereign country. But above all, I would say it's this erosion of the liberal democratic institutions, meaning the institutions which ensure democracies are real, a free press, a judiciary, the conventions, the norms, an independent civil service. I think he will politicize the entire US government to make sure it's Trump loyalists. And I think there should be concerns about the military too, which he may try and make answerable to him. I mean, these are all things he's talked about. So this is not sort of, Guardian Easter fantasy. These are all things he's discussed.
Another thing he's talked about is Elon Musk cutting federal spending by a third.
Yeah, he wants to put Musk in to oversee various agencies. His approach will be to slash whole departments by half and then halve them again. That's sort of his cost-cutting approach. He did it with, Twitter before turning into X. He'll do the same. That's his approach. He's told, I think, Trump that there's $2 trillion to be saved. And he'll say, oh, it's about cutting bureaucracy. But we know that will cut into the bone of what is already a pretty minimal welfare state. Hold on to your hats. I think this is going to be a very, very intense period, because one thing we have learned surely by now is don't underestimate Donald Trump, but also if somebody tells you who they are, believe them. And he has told us this, and he tried to do it last time. He went pretty far. This time there are no restraints. He'll get whoever he wants into the various positions. And the people who surround him now are true believers. They are not people who went in there last time out of patriotic duty, but with a view to thwarting him. One example, Stephen Miller, longtime aide, believes in a mass deportation program. Millions of people who are not documented as full citizens. He has talked about massive internment camps while they await deportation. That guy could be chief of staff in Trump's administration. You know that old thing about literally and seriously? I take Donald Trump both literally and seriously.
Now, I wanted to try and end this on a note of at least guarded optimism, which is almost impossible. But here's a question. In the end, if you're going to lance the boil of MAGA politics, of Trumpism, maybe the only way you're going to do it is through him winning, which proves that democratic systems are not rigged against him, which is what he and his supporters are constantly talk about. And then you let him do what he wants to do, which it, in all likelihood, is likely to result in policies that are very, very harmful to the people that voted for him. And then you're back to, one of the sort of flip sides of democracy always, which is if people vote for malign actors, they have to live with the consequences. And maybe that's the only sort of glimmer of awful hope in the midst of all this.
Yeah, it's funny. I had a text from a Democrat in the early hours saying something very similar. Look, firstly, these are coping strategies. Firstly, they now can't claim it was stolen, so that's something we won't hear any more of that. They won't even say that 2020 was stolen anymore, to which I say, you want to bet? I mean, I think they'll still keep going with that because they're not in the world of evidence and sort of fact and argument in that way. But no, I do understand what you mean. I mean, there is a sense in which, okay, let them have their head. And maybe the only way that people will recoil from this kind of nationalist, populist authoritarianism is when they see what it's really like. But, history is full of examples of that. And you have to go pretty low before you reach rock bottom and people recoil. We know how it ended in the middle of the last century and what it took for people to recoil. So I think the price is quite heavy with that. But look, maybe that's a very gloomy way of looking at it. Instead, maybe we think he does it and people see that he is not the panacea. And then they will finally be out of this. And as you say, will have lanced the boil of this movement. But it's now global. And if Trump had lost, I do believe it would have been a defining setback for nationalist populism around the world. And instead, it's yet another shot in the arm. And that movement is the movement of our time for this decade and perhaps into the next one. But I applaud the effort. We do need something to cling on to. And so maybe that is it.
I'm trying, Johnny. I'm trying. Anyway, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, John. Good to talk to you.
Thank you. Let's pause here for a minute. When we come back, we'll be joined by The Guardian's political correspondent, Kieran Stacey, to hear about Kemi Badenoch's first week as the Tory party leader.
How can governments play a pivotal role as the world shifts? From decarbonising the economy to sustainable care systems, bold government strategies are needed now more than ever. Get informed by listening to Government Insights, the new podcast from EY Parthenon. This series explores how government executives can transform their strategies into actions that are future-proof and sustainable. Government Insights is out now. Download today wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. I'm now joined by The Guardian's political correspondent, Kieran Stacey. Hello, Kieran.
Hey.
Here's an obvious question. I haven't asked you how you feel yet. Do you want to answer that in a
I'm a bit
sentence?
Tired, John. How are you?
A bit emotionally. Emotionally.
You know what? So I spent, as you know, several years in Washington, two of which were spent reporting on the final 2 years of the Trump White House. And so lots of people have been saying to me today, oh, I bet you wish you were back there. It's actually, although it is kind of fun and it's a great story to report on Trump being in the White House, it's also quite stressful as a reporter because what you end up doing is constantly chasing things that he says that he doesn't mean. So he'll kind of wake up in the morning, watch something on Fox News, tweet about it. You spend all day trying to figure out what he means. And then you realize by the end of the day, he doesn't mean anything by it. He's just kind of tweeting. So kind of, I'm getting flashbacks to those times, which were exhilarating, but also, as I say, quite stressful.
Yeah, you had a sort of hyper-driven version of what we all suffered from, I think, during those years. It was that sense of waking up every morning thinking, oh, God, what's he said now?
Yeah, exactly.
But that would define the rest of your day. Imagine that. Now, what do you feel was the reaction in Westminster to Wednesday morning's result? What have you been picking up?
I think there's still a sense of shock here, even though, you know, polls were clearly saying that there is a 50% chance of Trump getting in. Most people, I think, but maybe just emotionally, weren't really ready for that. So I spent part of election night on Tuesday night at a party surrounded by many ministers and also shadow ministers. And to be fair, I hope this isn't breaking any code of secrecy, but there was only one senior politician there who predicted Trump victory, and that was Ben Wallace, the former defense secretary, who looked at those early results and just turned to me and said instantly, Trump's going to win here. Almost everybody else, I think, was saying that they thought, oh, Harris is going to pull it out of the bag. There's been some late swing. The women are going to turn out for her. So I think that there just has been a sense of, oh my God, we can't quite believe this is the case. And then obviously on the government side, there is a lot of worry. There is a lot of concern. Firstly, that he's going to take quite a hostile approach to Britain and to the Labour Party, but also that their MPs are going to make things worse by saying things that they shouldn't.
Okay. I will ask you about that in just a second. Keir Starmer, as we both know, came out very quickly on Wednesday morning to congratulate Donald Trump. He issued a statement along those lines, and he did the same thing in Prime Minister's questions. And I just thought, looking at that, how sort of philosophically or mentally strange that must be, because his mind must be turning cartwheels, trying to process what on earth this will mean for Britain, Europe, the world, his job, the British economy, et cetera, let alone their one-to-one dealings. And because he's from the Labour side, we all know that him and the rest of the cabinet are profoundly uncomfortable and unsettled, and in many cases, just as worried and fretful as the rest of us. And yet he's got to give outwardly this dutiful appearance that this is to be welcomed and congratulations, President Trump.
Yeah, well, I mean, can you imagine being David Lammy? I mean, he was sitting there next to Keir Starmer on the front bench today at PMQs, watching his own words be read out against him. And they are. There is something about hearing those words, you know, when he was basically calling Trump a Nazi and saying he wouldn't be welcome in his city.
Should we just go through them again? It's always worth reading them out. Trump is not only a woman-hating, neo-Nazi-sympathising sociopath, he is also a profound threat to the international order, he was really mincing his words here, that has been the foundation of Western progress for so long, 2018.
And you know what? We obviously know he said those words. They've been brought up quite a lot recently. But there is something about hearing them when we know that Trump is going to be in the White House in a few months' time and watching David Lammy squirm on the front bench, trying to kind of get out of this position that he finds himself in. It was quite an embarrassing thing to watch. And obviously, he's not the only one.
Can you imagine being in the same room when Donald Trump was serving him mashed potatoes and they had dinner together?
A second helping.
Because let's not forget that's happened as well. Lammy and Starmer have met Donald Trump for dinner, which on the face of it was quite a clever move. But again, you boggle at the mental gymnastics required.
Well, the thing is, I know a few people who've met Trump who've been quite critical of him in public. And almost all of them say that when you meet him in person, he's incredibly charming and he doesn't seem to mind about anything that people have said before. What I will say is that Trump quite likes it when people have been rude about him and then come back into the fold, because he likes the loyalty that brings. So there are, I mean, J.D. Vance basically called him a Nazi beforehand, called him America's Hitler, and then got picked as the VP pick. Trump actually doesn't mind it if you've been rude about him, because he thinks that's likely to buy a level of loyalty that might not otherwise be the case. The problem is, of course, if you're the British Prime Minister, you can't show loyalty to the American president in the same way.
Yeah, sure. But if your bearing is sort of regretful and apologetic, that gives him power. I get
exactly.
That. Now, I think you said this a moment ago, or you hinted at it, that the cabinet has been kind of told to be quiet and keep their dismay to themselves. There are mixed messages on the Labour side, though, because Emily Thornberry, who is a backbencher now but is the chair of, remind me, Foreign Affairs Select Committee.
Foreign Affairs Select Committee, that's right.
She was quite outspoken on the radio, and that sort of symbolised how much unease there is in the Labour Party and what Starmer's got to keep a lid on.
Absolutely. So I was at this party last night, and a member of the cabinet walked in, came straight over to say hi, and obviously my first question to him was, what's your prediction? And he looked at me and he said, the British government is neutral. I said, what does that
Even
mean? What's your prediction? Anyway, it turns out that Simon Case, the cabinet secretary, wrote to the cabinet on Tuesday warning them, you know, when you go out tonight, don't make any predictions. Don't say what you want to be the case. The British government is neutral. I don't want any of you getting yourselves into trouble. Unfortunately, as you say, that message might have got through to cabinet ministers. But if you were a Labour backbencher, you wouldn't have seen that message, which is why I think you saw Emily Thornberry this morning on the radio being asked about past comments that she made about Donald Trump, and quite happily say, yes, that is what I think, but he's the president now, so we have to get on with it, which is admirably honest, but not particularly diplomatic. Now, what I'm told is after Emily Thornberry said those things on the radio, a message has gone out from the Labour whips warning other people not to do the same. They are very sensitive right now, and they know that just the slightest thing could blow up.
Now, let's talk about Kemi Badenoch. Today was her first PMQ. She was very outspoken on the front foot and belligerent and all those things. And much of what she challenged Keir Starmer on was about Donald Trump's election. Let's have a listen to some of what she said.
Mr. Speaker, discuss, chat. He has no plans whatsoever. No plans whatsoever for building on the special relationship.
As we both know, during her speech at the Conservative Party conference in October, she said she was really looking forward to being in opposition. She seemed pretty excited, made up, we would say, up north, to face Keir Starmer at PMQs. How do you think she did? I thought her sort of very belligerent, strident tone was not quite what I was expecting, and I couldn't make up my mind whether it sort of served her well or not, or whether she was overdoing it. What did you make of it?
Yeah, well, I mean, among our team here in Westminster, I think opinion is also divided. I thought she was pretty good, especially on that first question where she read out that quote that you've just read out, John, from
the
David Lammy.
Quote.
And she said to the Prime Minister, or she said, you know, asked of the Prime Minister, did he apologise when he had a meeting with Trump, when he was in the States? I thought that was a very good, pointed, punchy question. You know, just from a reporter's point of view, it was good to see a bit of life being brought back into PMQs, see a bit of opposition. I also, by the way, think it brings out the best in Keir Starmer. He had some excellent put downs, and he's often at his best, I think, when he's kind of pushed onto the back foot and forced to kind of come out all guns blazing a bit more than the softly, softly approach that we've seen from Rishi Sunak for the last few weeks. There's just two things, I think, that didn't bode so well for Kemi Badenoch in the long term that came through today. First of all, if you're going to try and create a dividing line between yourself and the government, and that is your job as leader of the opposition, you should probably try and put yourself on the right side of public opinion.
Exactly what I was thinking, yes.
Now, you know, the British public does not like Donald Trump. I'm not sure that they're going to, if they see clips of her from PMQs today, they're going to be thrilled at the idea of her standing up and saying, well, he should be invited to Parliament to give a speech to all of us. The other thing was, she, having said she wasn't going to make policy early on as leader of the opposition, she did make a bit of policy. She said she would reverse the inheritance tax cut for agricultural land. It's the trap to a certain extent that Ed Miliband fell into. It's a trap that a lot of leaders of the opposition fall into, where you think, well, I've just got to oppose every measure that's coming from the government, especially when it comes to budgets. We can make hay with this. But the accumulative effect of that is you kind of cement this idea in the public's mind that you can't be trusted with the public finances. And that's a bit of a risk for her.
And also, it sort of chimes with that perception of her that she's an all or nothing merchant, that she's a sort of political absolutist, no compromise, right?
Yeah.
And if, as you say, a response to the budget is, well, I'm not having any of it, that's not really the greatest thing, A, to address that perception of her, but B, in the context of the fact the Tory party's just been thumped. Because in my opinion, people tend to like at least a slightly contrite leader of the opposition, just when their party's suffered a thumping defeat. A sense tonally that they get that there's a job to be done reconnecting them with the public. But that's not what she does.
No, it's not. And she's not going to do it. The only thing I would say about that is that I think what people expect from politicians has slightly changed. And that's partly down to social media. And I think that's what you're seeing with Donald Trump. It's not like Donald Trump went out after he lost the last presidential election and said, I'm really sorry. These are all the things I've learned that I got wrong. Yeah. There is something now that I think the public doesn't mind a bit more punchiness from their politicians. And especially when, you know, a lot of what she says will just be clipped up and put on social media very quickly and designed to go viral to particular segments of a population. That can be quite an effective strategy.
There is one conservative politician or former conservative politician who springs to mind when one is drawing comparisons between Trump and the Tory party in the UK. Who similarly is sort of fancies his chances at doing the weave and rambling on for hours at a time.
Who has
can't comb
hair.
His own hair and all the rest of it. And there is a bit of talk around today about whether Boris Johnson will watch the Trump revival and therefore fancy his own chances of a comeback.
I think undoubtedly. I've always said that there is a strong chance of Boris Johnson being the man who leads the Tory party into the next election. I think that has been bolstered. I mean, apart from anything else, it's shown you that voters will forgive apparent malfeasance. It's one of the reasons, by the way, that I don't think Kemi Badenoch made such an error as lots of people do when she went on the Laura Koonsberg show over the weekend and said that Partygate wasn't such a big deal. My colleagues will disagree with me on this, but I think they're people are ready to stop talking about that. And the affection and warmth that they had for Boris Johnson prior to that scandal is returning. And certainly there is fertile ground for it to return. And I think he probably senses that too.
Well, Kieran, I was feeling bad enough already. You might have made me feel even worse. But thank you for joining us.
All right. Thanks, John.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, make sure you subscribe to Politics Weekly UK wherever you get your podcasts. And please leave us a review. For more coverage of the US election and its aftermath, please listen to Johnny Friedland on Politics Weekly America. And Today in Focus will be back tomorrow with The Guardian US's Washington DC Bureau Chief David Smith talking about what Trump might do in office. This episode of Politics Weekly UK was produced by Frankie Toby. The music is by Axel Cacoutier and the executive producers are Maz Ebtahaj and Nicole Jackson.
This is The Guardian.
How can governments play a pivotal role as the world shifts? From decarbonizing the economy to sustainable care systems, bold government strategies are needed now more than ever. Get informed by listening to Government Insights, the new podcast from EY Parthenon. This series explores how government executives can transform their strategies into actions that are future-proof and sustainable. Government Insights is out now. Download today wherever you get your podcasts.